This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
One, the most interesting man in the world. He once drove an 18-wheeler, set high school football records, trekked 17,000 miles across the Himalayas with Xi Jinping, and was arrested with Nelson Mandela. The Forrest Gump of American politics, our president, President Joe Biden. Two, inside America's drug crisis, from the flesh-eating trank on the streets of Philadelphia to the poisoning of America's youth with fentanyl, with the incomparable Douglas K. Murray. Three, my draft grades, the best three and worst drafts of the NFL. It is the Will Cain Show, streaming live at foxnews.com, on the Fox News YouTube channel, on the Fox News Facebook page, and always on demand by hitting subscribe at Apple or Spotify, or by hitting subscribe on YouTube. I find myself contemplative this Monday. I find myself thinking about we only get one trip around this world. We only get one chance at this life. Here's the deal. My youngest son turned 13 yesterday. We had a nice family birthday party. And at the end of the day, my wife decided to do that thing that is simultaneously fun and painful. She pulled up her digital photo accounts, and the four of us, my two sons, my wife, and I spent some time looking back over pictures. And I swear to you, I know that it's cliched, but there's a reason for cliches. There's a reason for stereotypes, and there's a reason for traditions. But it is so cliched and simultaneously true that it all goes so fast. I mean, it was literally yesterday that my son was like this tiny little thing that was squishy and full of laughter, and now he's lanky and tall and 13, and I wouldn't have it any other way. We have to grow. Life has to pass, but oh my God, does it pass fast. So I told my kids before I went to bed last night in a very fatherly manner, you only get one chance at this life, so take care of it and do everything you can. Live it to the fullest. So I did over the weekend, by the way. I spent countless hours in front of the television watching every single pick of seven rounds of the NFL draft while simultaneously watching the Mavs with an incredible comeback on Friday night and choke up an incredible comeback on Sunday. I wrung out sports from the life of this weekend. But I don't care how much we try to savor this life. I don't care how much we take a moment to look back at the pictures, to see time pass, to watch ourselves get older, to watch our children grow. We'll never wring as much out of this life as has Joe Biden. Let us start with story number one. The White House Correspondents' Dinner was on Saturday. It's the annual gathering of the Washington, D.C. press and the White House administration. It's supposed to be a collegial event where they tell jokes and spend time in a non-adversarial manner. The problem is the relationship between the press and power has long since ceased to be adversarial. So now it's become a little bit of a joke, an indulgence, a fiddle while Rome burns, as power and the press all commingle, have a cocktail. Colin Jost, Saturday Night Live host, was the MC of the event. And while he did make some jokes at the expense of Joe Biden, he spent most of his time focused on someone who is no longer president, Donald Trump. And at the end of his jokes about Joe Biden, which included looking for the puppet strings of Barack Obama, he said that the reason that Joe Biden is president is because America has returned to decency. He talked about his grandfather. He said that his grandfather was decent. His grandfather on Staten Island was a firefighter, and his grandfather voted for Joe Biden. He said that it was returned to decency. Miranda Devine, in a column up at the New York Post, really had an awesome rebuttal. She said, is this what we're supposed to believe is decent? That we now have yet another piece of evidence in the influence peddling scheme of the Biden family and the halls of government power with foreign entities from China to Ukraine, to the latest being that his brother Jim Biden has a profitable relationship with the state of Qatar. Is it decent to use your power to enrich yourself and your families? Is it decent to peddle influence? Is it decent to destroy the border, which leads to a drug crisis, which leads to destruction of a culture, which leads to the destruction of jobs? Is it decent to pretend that we're not a nation state and we shouldn't have a protected southern border to the United States of America? Is it decent to invite trans activists onto the lawn of the White House to expose themselves bare-chested? Is it decent to film pornography, to oversee a regime and an administration where literal pornography is filmed, gay porn, in the hearing chambers room of the United States Senate? Is it decent to refuse to acknowledge your grandchild until a court-required paternity test says, yes, that child is Hunter's, and now you can safely say you have one more grandchild? Is it decent to deny Secret Service protection to Robert F. Kennedy Jr.? Is all this supposed to be decent because we no longer have mean tweets from Donald Trump? Is this the definition of decency? And when Joe Biden took his turn at the podium at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, he took that moment to talk to the press about that they needed to take this stand athwart history and stop disinformation. Of course, it's an ironic thing for him to say. It's an ironic position for him to hold. Because in the confluence of decency and disinformation, late last week, he appeared with Howard Stern, where he told yet another fictional entry into his biography. The latest for his resume, arrested during the civil rights movement. Watch.
And I looked at my mom. I said, honey, you haven't said anything. She said, Joey, let me remember. True story. So remember when they were desegregating Linfield, the neighborhood, and it was, 70 homes built in suburbia? And I told you, and there was a black family moving in, and there was people were down there protesting. I told you not to go down there, and you went down. Remember that? And you came, got arrested, be standing on the porch with a black family.
Right.
And they brought you back, the police. And I said, yeah, Mom, I remember that.
This entire interview was disinformation. This entire interview was an embarrassment. It was yet another embarrassment to Joe Biden, but it was also an embarrassment to the man who describes himself as the king of all media. It was an absolute embarrassment for Howard Stern, who at one time was legitimately a rebel, who pushed the limits of the FCC, who changed radio, who could definitely have staked the claim to the greatest of all time at one time when it came to talk radio, at least outside the bounds of political talk, where, of course, who reigns supreme but Rush Limbaugh? But Howard Stern was legit. And Howard Stern was a rebel. Now Howard Stern is a hand-sanitizing, toting germaphobe who doesn't leave his protective bubble and kisses up, sucks up to power. Howard Stern of the 1990s, Howard Stern of the 2000s would be absolutely embarrassed by the Howard Stern of today. He spent one of his greatest skills, by the way, interviewing. He spent all that time interviewing the President of the United States, which amounted to a G-rated description would be providing a back massage to Joe Biden. But it's also an embarrassment for Joe Biden, whose lies are now so obvious that he's basically become the Forrest Gump of politics. His biography is hard to keep up with, but I tried. His biography is hard to chart, but I've tried. His biography is hard to reconcile, but Pete Hegseth and I did this weekend on Off the Wall on Fox and Friends. And so I thought we would go ahead and catalog Joe Biden, the fictional resume, the Forrest Gump of American politics. Let's start with his ethnicity. Joe Biden is the best, as best I can tell, Greek, once called Bidenopolis, raised in a Puerto Rican community. He always wanted to be Polish and has always had an affinity for the Polish community. Italian, but I think he admits that became by marriage. raised in a Jewish synagogue, simultaneously brought up in the black church. Joe Biden is a man of many ethnicities, but the only truth, if we're playing spot the truth and not spot the lie, is he's an Irish Catholic. A Polish, Greek, black, Jewish, Italian, Puerto Rican, Irish Catholic. His experience is even more fantastical. Here are the things Joe Biden has claimed to do in this one life. If my message when I began this show today was, we only get one trip, we only get one chance at this life, so take care of it and do everything you can. Boy, has Joe Biden done it all. He took those words to heart. He once, by claim, trekked 17,000 miles with Xi Jinping across the Himalayas. They racked up 17,000 miles of travel together, he and the premier of China. He was arrested during the civil rights movement from the front porch, as you just heard during that interview with Howard Stern. But it wasn't his only arrest in pursuit of racial justice. He was once arrested, according to his own telling, with our UN ambassador in South Africa, protesting for Nelson Mandela. No record, by the way, of either arrest. He once took the train, he said perhaps also a car, but took the train against the recently collapsed Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore. The trouble with that story is there were no train tracks ever on the Francis Scott Key Bridge. He holds a high school record, or actually he claims to be the runner-up in the high school scoring record for Delaware, but the truth of the matter is he got fifth in scoring in his conference within Delaware. He once said he was top of his class, top half of his class in law school. Records show he graduated 76th, 76th out of 85 in law school. He once drove an 18-wheeler. No real record of when, how, or why he drove that 18-wheeler. He, of course, fought corn pop while saving countless lives as a lifeguard when he was a child. Corn pop. Bad dude. And his uncle, whose plane crashed during World War II, legitimately, he claims to have been eaten by cannibals in Papua New Guinea. It's incredible, and it's probably only scratching the surface. The number of claims he has made in this life, certainly ringing it all out. The most interesting man in the world, the Forrest Gump of American politics, the fantastical disinformation, the life told by the toady to power Howard Stern, by the man of the highest power in the United States of America, Joe Biden, the return of decency. Let's dive into the American drug crisis from the flesh-eating drug taking the streets of Philadelphia, Trank, to the poisoning, literal poisoning by the Chinese and the Mexican drug cartels of America's suburban youth with fentanyl. Let's dive in with a man who went to the streets himself, Douglas K. Murray, next on The Will Cain Show.
Hey, it's Clay Travis. Join me for Outkick the Show as we dive deep into a mix of topics. New episodes available Monday to Friday on your favorite podcast platform and watch directly on outkick.com/watch.
It's something when you get a look at it. It's something when you see the skin falling off of somebody's legs. It's something when you hear about Trank or Croc. It's something when you hear about mixing fentanyl and cocaine. It's something that was seen by Douglas Murray in his new documentary on YouTube, America's Drug Crisis. That's coming up in just a moment here on The Will Cain Show. Streaming live at FoxNews.com, on the Fox News YouTube channel, the Fox News Facebook page, and always on demand. Hit subscribe at Apple or Spotify or on YouTube. Douglas Murray did hit the streets of Philadelphia. He hit the dark web on how you get to hold of fentanyl. He did talk to the parents of children who have died from thinking they were buying, yes, illicit, illegal drugs, but something like cocaine, instead getting it laced intentionally, by the way, with fentanyl. And his new documentary is certainly fascinating. Here's a little clip from America's Drug Crisis.
How often do you do this?
Every day.
Every day.
Make sure those cops don't come over here.
You're burning up fentanyl. How do you feel?
All the pain goes away.
America stands at a crossroads.
This is a tourist attraction. People travel here for the drugs.
Its solutions to the ongoing drug crisis aren't working.
The train's intentional. It's there to drown out our screams.
North America now has the highest rate of opioid use of any region in the world.
You go to a spot like this, they give you a shot of fentanyl in the morning, and you come in the night and they give you a shot of fentanyl at night. Fentanyl.
Fentanyl takes the life of an American every 5 minutes.
Immediately that she had been poisoned with fentanyl.
Fentanyl is now found in recreational drugs like cocaine and even weed. With hundreds of thousands of Americans dying every year, the question remains, how did we get here and how do we get out? I'm Douglas Murray, and this is America's Drug Crisis.
That 26-minute documentary is on YouTube, and we're going to talk to Douglas about that. Hopefully, we're hoping to be joined by Douglas Murray a little bit later here on The Will Cain Show. We'll talk about that experience of walking the streets of Philadelphia. Hopefully, we haven't lost Douglas to the streets of Philadelphia, and we'll get him before the end of this show today here on The Will Cain Show. But we're going to break down my best and worst, what I took away from spending a weekend tuned into all seven rounds of the NFL draft. So who was the worst and who was the best? Which teams nailed it? Which teams failed? I'm going to give you three failures and three successes according to the draft value chart from Will Cain. All right, here are your three best drafts in the NFL. First, I really liked the draft of the Green Bay Packers. Now, Dane Brugler of The Athletic, who I think does one of the best jobs pre and post draft, talking to you about the players that your team just drafted, ranked the Packers 21st after the NFL draft. I like the Packers much more. With 11 picks, I like what they did. They took Jordan Morgan, an offensive lineman in the first round, Edgerrin Cooper, a linebacker from Texas A&M in the second, Javon Bullard. They got a great running back out of USC, Marshawn Lloyd. And late in the draft, they got a center out of Duke, Jacob Monk. With 11 picks, you can fill a lot of needs. The NFL draft is a crapshoot. We know that for almost every position. So the answer to that is either the best you can do at can't miss, which really is in the top 5 to 10 picks of the draft, or quantity over quality. And that's going to take me for a moment for another team that didn't make my top three, but I do like something that they did that fulfills one of my draft strategies. And that's the New England Patriots. At the top of the draft, the New England Patriots drafted with the 3rd pick, Drake May, quarterback out of North Carolina. Now, look, picking a quarterback is at best a 50-50 proposition, that he's going to be your, forget franchise quarterback, that he's going to be your starter within 3 years. If we rewind the clock 3 years to 2021, there were 5 quarterbacks taken in the first round. Do you know how many today remain starting with the team that drafted them? One. That's Trevor Lawrence for the Jacksonville Jaguars. The rest of them are backups. Maybe they'll once again be starters like Justin Fields in Pittsburgh. But the rest of them for now are backups and with some other team. So the way to handle that, in my estimation, is you buy insurance policies. I used to say on the Will Cain Show on ESPN, draft, and draft again when it comes to quarterbacks. So what I like is that the Patriots came back later in the draft and took quarterback from Tennessee, Joe Milton. Now, I think that does a couple of things. It provides you a little bit of an insurance policy, so you've increased your odds that one of them works out. But what it also does is if, say, it is May that actually works out, but Milton plays decently, you know, in the preseason, you've got to trade or fills in for injury, you've got a trade value. And I can't remember what they spent on Milton. I think it was like a 5th rounder. But like the Patriots in the past did the same thing with Jimmy Garoppolo and Tom Brady and ended up trading Jimmy Garoppolo for a 2nd round pick to San Francisco. That's making money. That you have a good backup for several years, then you trade him away, you've made money on the draft capital. So if Milton's okay, but so is Drake May, no harm, no foul, you probably get to trade away Milton for increased value on what you spent to acquire Milton. And if May's no good, you've now increased your odds you found a quarterback with Milton. So quantity, to me, is the key when it comes to the NFL draft. That's what I like about the Packers. The entire NFC East, according to Dane Brugler, was in the top 10 of the NFL draft. I'm talking about everybody loved the Eagles. The Giants were ranked 7th. The Cowboys were ranked 10th. And the Commanders were ranked 9th. I actually like, because I'm a man of objectivity, the draft of the Washington Commanders. I like Jaden Daniels from LSU. He's my favorite quarterback in this draft. I like Johnny Newton, the defensive tackle they took in the 2nd round. Mike Sainristil, cornerback. Luke McCaffrey, the son of Ed McCaffrey, wide receiver from Rice, they took later in the draft. I actually think I look at this and I see now where the Commanders, after years of ineptitude, have a path forward. But the best draft, and Dane Brugler ranked them second, and I think it's my favorite draft, is the Pittsburgh Steelers. They have Troy Fautanau, an offensive lineman, Zach Frazier, center, offensive lineman, Roman Wilson, wide receiver, and the biggest gamble, which the Cowboys used to do this, they used to take guys in the second, third round that were injury risks, that were first-round talent, Peyton Wilson, linebacker from North Carolina State. I love this draft by the Pittsburgh Steelers. That takes us to the Cowboys for a moment. You know, the Cowboys are mixed. Brugler, as I mentioned, has them ranked 10th. I see other grades putting them, like, as a D, as one of the worst. And the D is basically because they didn't take a running back. They didn't take a running back. Well, look, we've argued, everyone in the NFL has argued, running backs don't matter. They're devalued. Well, the Cowboys are definitely testing that theory. I think they're re-signing Ezekiel Elliott. But they did draft where the team should be built, all teams, offensive line and defensive line. And I think they did a good job. Cooper Beebe, Kansas State, Tyler Guyton, Oklahoma, Nate Thomas, Louisiana, building a big offensive line. They also took Marshawn Nealon in a value pick at defensive line in the second round. I like the Cowboys draft. I don't love it. It's not a top three, but I like the Cowboys draft. Now here are your bottom three drafts according to the Will Cain value chart. All right. The Minnesota Vikings just can't do it. Can't do it with J.J. McCarthy. One of my favorite accounts, Ghetto Gronk, said, it's like your aunt's special friend that comes over for Thanksgiving. Take a look at J.J. McCarthy and tell me it doesn't look like your aunt's lesbian friend. The Houston Texans, no pick in the top 40. It's hard to be great. I don't like the Houston Texans draft. And the Denver Broncos, not only Bo Nix at 12, but honestly, what do any of us know? I don't know a lot of these names for the Broncos. And that's the thing about the draft. The grades don't matter. We'll know in 3 years. We'll know in 3 years with all these teams. But for now, I don't like the Broncos, Texans, and Vikings. They're your best and worst drafts from the NFL. We did not lose him to the streets of Philadelphia. In fact, we have returned him to civilization. And coming up in just a moment here, we're going to talk to Douglas Murray on The Will Cain Show. Man, it's something you just got to see. You got to see people choosing to take a flesh-eating drug. And then I've got to see the grief of parents who see that their children did not choose to take fentanyl. It's all highlighted in a new documentary by Douglas Murray, America's Drug Crisis. Let's, in fact, do that next here on The Will Cain Show, streaming live at foxnews.com, the Fox News YouTube channel, the Fox News Facebook page. Subscribe, Apple, Spotify, or on YouTube. He is the author of 7 books, including The War on the West. He's a columnist at the New York Post, and as I mentioned, also a documentarian of Douglas Murray Investigates America's Drug Crisis. Hey, Douglas.
Hey, Will. Good to be with you again.
So I watched your documentary. It's 26 minutes. It's a nice length. It's, man, it's something. I mean, we can talk about it, and statistics are cold, and sometimes even listening to someone's family who's been lost to fentanyl, I don't want to say that it's harder to resonate with that, but when you just see firsthand these people choosing to take drugs like Trank and just watching their own skin eat away from them, it's just something to see on your television screen has got to be something to see in person, Douglas.
Yes. I mean, I've been looking into this story for about a year or so now. I've always been interested in it because I think that there's something very strange that's happened in America in recent years where we've sort of got used to the idea that, yeah, you know, 107,000 Americans die in a year of overdose deaths. But, you know, well, what can we do about it? I'm sort of stunned by that. I mean, more than 100,000 of your citizens every year dying from a preventable cause should be something that, you know, is way beyond politics. And yet we instead, it's sort of gone the other way. It's accepted like the weather or something. And it's not a natural disaster. It's not inevitable. And the human misery that it causes that I saw, and you know, I've seen a lot of American cities, but I focus obviously on New York and Philadelphia in this documentary and in my recent pieces for the Post, because partly it's because in a city like, say, San Francisco, the drug problem is sort of relatively spread out. In Philadelphia, it's condensed in particular into this one area known as Kensington Avenue. And it's just the condensed version of the much bigger American drug crisis. And you're right, the scenes that you see there are, I mean, it includes injuries and wounds that I haven't seen outside of war zones.
And why? So I remember it was, because it's dead. It was a joke mostly of a journalistic institution, Vice. But I do remember Vice doing pieces, and I remember them doing one in Russia on people taking something called Croc. So I think that's where they mixed a lot of like household cleaning products together with some other stuff that gave them a high, and it ate their skin away. And I remember looking at that. I think they became scaly, and then it became abscesses, and they eventually lost limbs. And even then, though, it's like, well, that's Russia. That's far away. You know, there's a different level of, you know, of poverty and maybe even depravity, you know. But this is here. And tell me about Trank. Like, because the images in your documentary, it's the same as what I saw in Russia. Yeah. I mean, it is abscesses and limbs wasting away.
Yes, I mean, it leads to severe necrosis and amputation of limbs, or limbs just falling off. Trank is relatively new into the drug supply in the U.S. It's come in the last few years. Philadelphia is a sort of ground zero for it, and it started to spread out from there around parts of the rest of the country as well. It's like fentanyl. It's one of these relatively new things that's come into the drug supply. Some people know that they're taking it. Others don't know. Others don't care, sadly. But yes, I mean, it's the Trank that's leading to the worst wounds, but it's the fentanyl that's leading to the most deaths. And that is simply because it's more widespread at the moment in America. I mean, this is to do with the supply of drugs into America. And I still don't think that enough American parents and indeed their children realize what has actually gone on with the American drug supply in recent years. This is not, experimenting with drugs now is not like it was in the 1960s, where somebody had a few puffs of marijuana and got into the summer of love. This is a drug supply, obviously coming through Mexico, some of it made in Mexico, much of it made in China, synthetic opioids. And what happens is that a drug like fentanyl, which is lethal in the tiniest imaginable quantities, has found its way into the supply of drugs like cocaine in America, into the supplies of heroin. If you're a habitual heroin user, as I discovered, you might be on 10 bags of heroin a day, but the fentanyl will give you a high because the heroin no longer does it. But if you are somebody who is totally unused to the fentanyl and takes a recreational drug, and as I found out, you know, fentanyl has even been found in the weed supply in America. So, and there are people who have died thinking they're going to smoke a joint and the joint has got fentanyl in it. And the catastrophic injuries this causes. I mean, somebody who I spoke with, a couple whose daughter died of it's one of three professionals in New York who died one Friday night a couple of years ago, because the drug dealer, the cocaine supplier in New York to young professionals, was selling cocaine laced with fentanyl, and he'd cut it himself, so he had total responsibility for that. But one of the grieving parents told me that when the first responders, the police, went into her apartment, to her and the other people, it was like they'd been shot in the back of the head. The body just collapses. It's unbelievably dangerous what is happening. And as I say, right. until people realize this and that it's really different from anything we've seen before, this is going to just keep rocketing out of control.
So I have a lot of follow-up questions. I'm going to do one more on Trank before I get back into fentanyl, because I have a lot of questions about what you said about fentanyl. Tell me the why on Trank real quick. Like, so I think you said in the documentary, it's for large animals, it depresses the central nervous system. So what is that? It's an opioid type effect, and people are choosing yes. to take it, and are they mixing it with something, or they're just getting their hands on this horse cocktail and taking it and watching
it
their skin eat away?
To be that they're getting their hands on it. Probably not. I mean, I spoke to one addict who sort of said that it has sort of found its way into the drug supply that he had, and he'd been injecting for about 8 years, I think. He certainly wasn't eager to be taking Trank, but it had ended up in his drug supply. But quite often this seems to happen, like with fentanyl, because the drug that's being cut in to the main drug is cheaper. And I would expect that right. somewhere back in the line, whoever's cutting the drugs has put in Trank as a relatively cheap substitute for something else, like heroin. But yes, I mean, it's probably the
It looks like leprosy.
It's like leprosy.
It looks like they have leprosy.
It's also, it causes this horrific thing, which I saw a lot of in Philadelphia and elsewhere, but particularly in Philly, where people kind of freeze like statues. I mean,
I see those videos. That they're on Trank, those people?
Yeah, a lot of those are on Trank. And they literally just will stand up, they'll remain standing, hunched over, and freeze, and just be like that for ages. And you discover so many interesting and awful things when looking at this subject. But I mean, one thing I discovered was that I spoke to a local doctor who said, you know, well, the thing is, the hospitals aren't very keen on bringing these people in, because if we obviously have a duty to revive them, but they can very often get violent with the medical staff because they've interrupted their high. Now, you and I might think, well, what the hell was the enjoyment you were getting from being a frozen statue on the street? But, you know, we're dealing with a real crisis here.
In your documentary, you focused on Narcan, and Narcan is now over the counter. That's the reviver, that you can revive someone who's about to die from fentanyl or opioid. But I've had my own conversations with cops who've said, you've got to be careful because they wake up mad. Like,
yes, that's right.
They're on the edge of death. They're sitting there beginning to hold hands with the devil. Right. And you bring them back to the light, life, and they're mad you messed up their high with Narcan.
That's right. And by the way, lest anyone think again that this is some kind of fringe problem in America, Narcan, you've just referred to, the thing that can revive somebody from an overdose, it's a nasal ingestion spray, and you just shoot it up somebody's nose and it kind of kicks the brain back to life. Governor Hochul and the health authorities in New York State recommend that all New Yorkers carry Narcan with us. That is the recommended health advice in New York State, that every New Yorker should be walking around with Narcan. Now, you may say, well, why? Because of the enormous number of overdose deaths in New York. Now, again, going back to what I said at the beginning, Will, you know, that's not normal, or it shouldn't be normal. That is the health advice for New Yorkers, that because you're likely to stumble over somebody overdosing on the subway, in the street, or at a party, you should have this thing that was previously only used and needing to be used by medical professionals.
Mm-hmm. I didn't realize, so I've seen those pictures, and they all come from that Kensington Street in Philadelphia, of those people frozen, like you said. And what's wild about them being frozen is they're so off balance. Like, they look like they would tip over with the slightest push. So I don't know what it is in Trank. It shuts down the central nervous system, but somehow maintains some ballerina balance in there. I don't know how they're standing, is the point. They should be on the ground. I don't get it.
Well, a lot of people are on the ground. I mean, I saw a guy inject an overdose in I don't know if he overdosed. He suddenly injected just as I was there, and went staggering down the street, and these bizarre movements, as you say, it's like the body in flight. And then he just sort of collapsed down the street and lay there, you know. And one of the sad things about it, a young schoolgirl, a young Black American schoolgirl, walked past, said to me, "Is he dead?" And I was just checking that his lips weren't going blue. I said, "I don't think so." And she said, "This is effed up. This is effed up." You know, yeah. That was her. This is a schoolgirl. Wow. Like, why is she growing up in a city in which that she's just used to treading over potentially dead bodies?
Right. Back to fentanyl. So, you know, the answer is easy, and I think you've already given it to us. I guess the answer is tolerance. But we talk so much about fentanyl and how, like, you know, 1 microgram of fentanyl can kill you. But then you've got in your documentary a guy outside of, by the way, a safe use center, shooting it up himself, fentanyl. He's got a needle, and he's shooting fentanyl into his arm. And I'm like, how is he doing that when we hear all these stories of other people who encounter, even cops, you know, some microgram of it and get killed? And I guess the answer is just tolerance.
It's a tolerance thing. I discovered that guy in question. Yes, that was just in Washington Heights. He uses heroin, therefore needs, and the heroin that he takes keeps him. I didn't realize this until then. It just keeps you at a level. It doesn't actually give you the high after a certain amount of time. So the high is sought from the fentanyl. Now, he has a particular tolerance for it because he's obviously doing it all the time. And he burned up the fentanyl, shot it up in front of me in the street, which I didn't ask him to do. He just showed me. And there was a cop car just behind us. And, you know, the lights flashing. I was sort of, you know, couldn't believe it, really. But I also spoke to a dealer on camera, who said to me that the danger with his clients was that if they're taking heroin plus fentanyl and they go into prison for some other offense, or sometimes a drug-related offense, not often it seems, the danger point is when they come out, because they're immediately trying to go on what they had before. Whereas, in fact, if they've had any withdrawal in prison, which they're likely to have done, their tolerance for the fentanyl has gone back down. So he said, actually, quite often what happens is people come out of prison, they take what they were taking before, and they die. So
I've heard that about rehab as well.
Tolerance thing.
Yeah. Yeah, people that go to rehab don't realize their tolerance has been totally adjusted. Do what they did before they went into rehab and die. Yeah. So Douglas, you and I've had conversations about, you know, Israel, Ukraine. I've always made this argument. I don't think we've ever talked about this in particular, specifically in Iran. And I'm going to tie this into drug dealers, but like, I've always seen Iran, Douglas, as a rational actor, meaning, yeah, they have a dystopian, you know, or in their minds, utopian worldview of total Islamic domination. But in pursuit of that irrational goal, they will make rational choices, meaning self-preservation, survival. That's the most, ultimately, at the base, that is the most rational human motivation. Like, if we all understand that everybody on the same page wants to continue to survive, we can at least move forward with some rational steps. That's the hard thing about a suicide bomber. Can't do anything about that guy. He's off the reservation when it comes to reason. The drug dealer is a rational actor. Like, he doesn't want to get busted. He doesn't want to lose his clientele to death. So I've always been curious. You even have that drug dealer who cut his coke with fentanyl. And shocking moment, he's got a text to another dealer saying, "Hey, give this to some girls and see what happens." It's an irrational act. Now, maybe he's a moron, right? But I would think that drug dealers, Douglas, wouldn't want to be poisoning their clientele. I would think they wouldn't want to be giving people who don't want fentanyl, because they either risk arrest or death. And so I've never been able to figure out why fentanyl is in things where the client doesn't want it to be fentanyl.
So quite often it's simply that the drugs are mixed in, you know, a laboratory, if you want to call it that, in Mexico, and that the standards of hygiene and separation of powers isn't exactly what it could be in a Mexican drug lab. Who'd have thought? So a lot of it is going to be at that point in the supply. The dealer who you refer to there, who killed the three people in New York, it was found guilty of their deaths and sentenced to prison. What he did is that it seemed clear that he knew that he had what he called strong staff. And then when he didn't hear from the three people he'd sold to that evening, he tried to sell it on to another dealer. He was completely culpable. But you're right that that's relatively unusual. And dealers that I spoke to said that, well, you know, I wouldn't do that. Why would I cut other drugs in? I want the client to remain hooked. And I want their business.
Right.
But I think what people have to realize is simply, you know, maybe you'll get a dealer like that. Maybe you'll get one like the one who was going around Manhattan selling fentanyl-laced cocaine. The whole thing has become such a deadly gamble. And you could say, well, it always was. And that's true to some extent, but not like this. So, you know, I said in my series of pieces in the Post about this whole crisis that the reason why I wanted to start in Philly and end with that particular story of the three New York professionals was, Americans don't think this is other people problem. Don't think this is like lower class, working class, you know, people whose lives aren't in order or anything. No, it may not affect you, but the likelihood it'll affect somebody you know or somebody you love has become very, very high in America. We have a postal service that one dealer said to me is the best and biggest drug supply operation in the U.S. So it's not just big towns, it's small towns, it's everywhere. And this isn't another people problem.
I can't say that I've had like anybody in my family or even maybe a one degree of separation to my family who has died of fentanyl, but I think 2 to 3 degrees of separation, the answer is definitely yes. I know this family who sent their kid to college, he bought an Adderall online, dead.
Right.
I know this family who went to college, bought this Xanax online, fentanyl, dead. Those stories, and we're not talking about the ones that are on the news, they're the ones that you hear at the the barbecue. You know, those stories are definitely around. I mean, they're. I pray it doesn't touch much closer, but that's the one thing I tell my boys. Do not take pills, any kind of pill. You don't. And by the way, you know, I don't want my boys doing anything, right?
No.
I have not heard anecdotally the story of weed that you talk about. I haven't heard that one. The story in your documentary is cocaine. I've heard about the pills. But if it's getting in everything, you know, I mean, I got to be honest. I even watched a documentary. I was like, I'm addicted to Zyn. Now, it's a regulated over-the-counter product. That's the nicotine pouches. I'm like, what do I know about what's in it? You know, I mean, everything you're taking at some point, it just gets terrifying.
Well, yeah, I mean, the reality of that, at least, you're buying it from a regulated source.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the tragedy of the kind of, and I've heard even more since the documentary came out, I've heard from a lot of families across America. And one of the ones that is what you just referred to, which is somebody buying pills in Mexico, for instance, thinking that they are Xanax, and they turn out to have fentanyl. It happened again just a couple of weeks ago. A young college guy went to Mexico on a holiday with his friends and bought something he thought was you know, just going to be a downer, and it killed him. So. You know, I just
think in Mexico, those look like pharmacies too.
Absolutely,
I've been to those.
Exactly.
They look like pharmacies. Like you walk up, you're like, this looks professional, you know?
Yeah. And sometimes there's even a person in a white coat. You just don't know what it is actually they're selling you. And I just think there's, I'm glad you said that about your kids, because I think one of the things that American parents are going to have to realize is that, you know, this is different. The whole society, in a way, we need to update our software, our mental software, about how we approach this whole issue. And it's such a difficult issue that it's not something I'm particularly dogmatic about. I just say that, you know, that there are some people who think the solution is to make safe use sites, or make sure the drug supply is tested more, or there are places for safe injection and so on. And I think that solves a bit of the problem. It doesn't solve the addiction problem. It arguably ignites that. It could help solve the fentanyl poisoning problem. But this is just vast, Will. I mean, as you know, this is just a vast story.
And I came away from your documentary.
Going through it. You know, I was in Australia recently, and Australia has lots of problems, but it doesn't have this problem.
Oh, it doesn't?
Well, I mean, no one has the epidemic problem like America. I mean, fentanyl has found its way into other markets. It has cropped up in Scotland. It has cropped up in a lot of countries. But I'm saying that the phenomenon of, like, just accepting that your major cities will have people shooting up on the streets. Almost every other country in the developed world, every country has a drug problem, every country. But if you want to go to, like, find the drug problem in Glasgow, you will have to go and find it, and it's mainly going to be in, like, private houses and so on. But the idea that your streets will be covered with it. And I had some friends visiting in New York a little while ago. And, you know, first morning they're staying with me, we walk out, and a guy coming into my building says, I wouldn't go out right now. I said, well, why? He said, the guy's just shot up there, and he's staggering around. Sure enough, outside my building in New York, the guy is staggering around with a needle. These friends from the UK were like, what? I mean, like, that's normal? I say, yeah, that's kind of normal in New York. Yeah, there's a guy shooting up heroin in his arm and staggering around the street. Yeah, that's kind of normal. Other people don't think it's normal. They just don't.
Right. No, and I'll be honest, I don't see that a lot in New York. You know, I spend 2 or 3 days a week in New York. I'm in Midtown and the Upper West Side mostly, but I don't see that. I'm not rebutting that it exists. I just, your documentary was a little depressing, well, as it would be.
It's hard to do a comedy on this subject.
Well, like you said, like, you don't provide us at the end a solution. And
no.
I think it's because one doesn't exist, you know? I mean, the easy answer is do the minimum. The minimum would be secure the border best possible. That's not going to solve it all, right? But it certainly hurts it that the border's wide open.
It is the minimum. Well, I mean, it just is. Everything has to start from there. It's like, how is it that synthetic Chinese opioids have ravaged America? They've got in. And yeah, it doesn't solve everything, but securing the border should not be such... I also can't understand why it's a partisan issue. Why can't people just agree that if there was a way to save 100,000 Americans every year, this is a good thing to do? And it would be very, very much easier to save those lives if you simply secured the border.
What? So you just a couple more questions here, Douglas. So you talk about securing the border, you talk about drug enforcement, you talk about laws, you talk about those safe use, you know, logistical areas. You've got that lady who's very good hearted in the documentary, who's trying to help people who are in this situation. And she's basically like, you know, she kind of makes the argument for legalization. She says, you go to a bar, you know, you're not going to buy moonshine and go blind. You know, we should do the same thing with drugs, where, you know, at least we can ensure some level of safety, I guess, and regulation to it.
Yeah.
And I don't know where you are on that. And even as we're talking about, like, I do wonder, again, I don't know about marijuana being poisoned with fentanyl. I haven't heard that story, but I do wonder, like, well, if that happens, is it happening in... New Mexico and Colorado at the, you know, the legalized weed stores, or is that a protection mechanism? Right. I'm like you. I'm not dogmatic. I want to secure the border. I do think drugs should be illegal, but I'm not convinced that either of those positions solve this issue.
No, I mean, there are people who simply say, well, we, you know, the war on drugs has failed, therefore let's legalize. Other people say we haven't really tried the war on drugs. Again, I mean, I would just go back to this point that this is different. This is different from previous drug issues. The problem with the idea of legalizing it, as I see it, is that you have this really big problem, which is, in the end, it's not like going to a bar. You know, you can go to a bar,
right?
Never drunk rum before. You'll order your rum. It won't be moonshine. And if you order a lot of rum, you might have a sore head the next day. But it's not likely you're going to die. The drugs we're talking about, whether heroin or, you know, the other drugs that seem to be the major problems, various opioids, these are like, they get you a lot further, a lot faster than any of the things we have that are legal in society at the moment. It's nothing like tobacco use. It's nothing like the use of alcohol. So I find that the idea that you would have these incredibly addictive and lethal drugs sort of tested for that they don't have the ultimate lethality in them of something cut into them, I think would be to introduce an even wilder Wild West into the American drug market. And I don't think it's one that society could actually live with. I think it would cause a kind of complete breakdown. You know, because we've got to remember, a lot of people, they start off by just experimenting. But you can experiment with alcohol, and, you know, a lot of people have tricky relationships with alcohol throughout their whole life. But it has nothing like the potency of what we're talking about, the drugs. And, you know, we've seen it in recent years with, of course, the legal opioids that have been available on the American drug market, and the horrors that unleashed across America in terms of addiction. So I don't think that's a good route. And, you know, I have sympathy with the people who say, look, maybe we never will win this war. It's not a winnable war. But it's a war worth waging anyway. I would simply say the most desirable thing is to get it off the streets. That is just basic. You know, it's right to think about the rights of addicts and homeless people and others, but it's also necessary to think of the rights of a population. And if you get a safe use site like the one in Washington Heights, go up near your home. Around a 10-block radius from that site, there will be needles everywhere. And residents up in Washington Heights have all testified to this, that since the safe use site opened, everywhere around it has gone down. Of course. So I'd say, yeah, think of the rights of these residents.
It's almost like, did you ever watch The Wire? Like, create Hamsterdam?
Of course.
That's what he did. Yeah. He's like, can't solve it, so we're just going to shove it over here into this one area of the city and let them have at it, whatever happens in that area of the city. It's also hard to find that legalization line like you're talking about. I think you're right. I was just in my head thinking maybe the line is something like you can, you know, I drink off and on. I think I have a healthy relationship with alcohol. I probably, like anything else, would like to drink more or less because it's, I know inherently it's not good for me. But you know people who have, how about this, a not unhealthy relationship with alcohol. You could say the same thing about tobacco.
Yes.
Maybe you can make that same argument for marijuana. You can't come up with people that have a healthy relationship with heroin, I think, unless I'm open to the rebuttal of that in case somebody knows. But like, you know, we all know alcoholics. We all know people dying from emphysema. But we also know people who have a social drink and they have a healthy relationship with the vice. You can't find that when it comes to the drugs that we're talking about.
No, because you, for obvious reasons, I mean, one is, again, is the just magnificently addictive quality of it. I mean, you know, there are certain drugs where users will tell you they tried it for the first time and they thought, oh, this is good. This is my drug. And, you know, apart from anything else, you become, you know, to riff off what you were just saying, I mean, you know, we've all heard the phrase like functioning alcoholic. There is no such thing as a functioning heroin user. There's not a functioning injector of hardcore drugs. By nature, it will take over their life. And again, on the toxicity thing, I mean, there's other drugs I didn't have time to go into in this documentary, but other drugs that are sort of seen as being party drugs, where again, because the strength has upped, it used to be like, you know, 18 months from getting onto the drug to like the bottom falling out of your life, which means, you know, you lose all your friends, you lose your partner, probably you'll lose your house and your job. Now the strength of some of these drugs, it means basically your life falls apart within a couple of months. And
jeez,
you know, that's not enough time to calibrate, really. That's, you know, like people say, oh, I needed to hit rock bottom. I go, you didn't need your life to hit rock bottom that fast and at a young age very often. So
I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, I'm saying, I mean, this is another example of like, we have to be wiser to this. Parents have to be wiser to this. Kids have to be wiser to it. That we're dealing in a totally different market now.
Streets of Kiev, for sure, and various parts of Ukraine. West Bank, Israel. Where does Kensington and Philadelphia or Washington Heights late at night rank on your, I don't feel so safe where I am right now scale?
Quite high, actually. Quite high. I mean, I've been in plenty of war zones. And one of the things about war zones is that you kind of always, well, at least my view is always, I take the view on rockets and things, which is that it's just a roulette. It may land on you, it may not. But there's a sort of, you know, fatalism about it. The only really unpleasant thing in a war zone, I think, is when you know you've got a sniper on you. And that's unpleasant because it feels personal. Well, it is personal. the places like Kensington after dark, the problem is it can all just go south so fast. You just need one angry addict. I mean, I learned when I was there that a lot of the users come in the daytime to buy their drugs and then get out because they know it's unsafe after dark. And yeah, I mean, it's a very, very unsafe place. And I feel so sorry for the families who live nearby. You know, one of the unacknowledged, you know, consequences. It's not their fault they happen to be in an area that's not that well off. But they did not need to live in an area where it's unsafe to go out of your house and where you will see unbelievable scenes all the time. And so, yes, and I'd just add one other thing, which is, there is an element to this, which again, I don't understand the lack of urgency about this. Most of the women who are using will be, you know, people have said to me since the documentary came out, like, how do they afford this, these kind of habits? And one of the answers is most of the women will be selling their bodies in some way. So this whole thing, a lot of them will, let me say, this whole thing has lots of extra dimensions of human misery apart from the drugs that come because of the drugs. So, you know, if anyone thinks that's to be encouraged or, you know, tolerable, I'd just say, like, what about taking this from a different route, right? What about thinking of these women and whether or not that is the life which should be laid out for them? Because I don't think anyone starts out wanting that life. And they've got into it because of a toxic drug supply and a set of bad life decisions, which, you know, we would all hope not to make, but people make them.
Right. And that's one side of the spectrum. The other is the intentional poisonings that take, you point out in the documentary, America's Youth. I think you just got to see it, to be honest. And it's right here. If you're watching on YouTube, you can easily click over. It's Douglas Murray Investigates America's Drug Crisis. It's really high quality, by the way. Douglas, I know how hard of work these kind of things are. I know you put some work into this, your production team, your editing team. This took time, and this is really well done. So I think everyone should check it out. And I appreciate you jumping on with us today because I, after seeing it, I really want to talk about it. Thanks, Douglas.
No, it's a great pleasure. Great to see you, Will. Take care.
All right. Take care. Again, Douglas Murray Investigates America's Drug Crisis. It's on YouTube. You can check it out. It's really fascinating. All right, that's going to do it for us today. We'll be back right here again tomorrow. If you'll remember, last week we had tech entrepreneur, former COO of PayPal, David Sacks, on the show to talk about Ukraine. Well, that received a lot of pushback, a little bit of backlash. One of the people that pushed back on me inviting David Sacks onto the Will Cain Show will have her chance to jump on now and make her case about the war in Ukraine. That's tomorrow on the Will Cain Show. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcast and Amazon Prime members. You can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.